Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, May 8th. I'm Joel Ficklin, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Redway Raid reveals illegal grow operations and a suspected worker exploitation. Humboldt supervisors join opposition to sex offenders release. And Voices of Victory, South Fork Cubs softball team speaks to KMUD after first league victory title in 35 years. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. An early morning house fire in Rio Dell on Thursday has claimed the life of a man believed to be in his 50s and sent his 77-year-old father to the hospital with a hand injury, according to local authorities. The blaze broke out just after 7:20 a.m. in the 1,000 block of Riverside Road. Witnesses reported seeing thick smoke and flames pouring from the corner of the home, with neighbors attempting to control the fire using garden hoses before emergency crews arrived. Rio Dell Volunteer Fire Department Chief Shane Wilson said firefighters encountered heavy flames at the structure, which had long been under abatement for safety violations and lacked electricity, gas, or legal occupancy. Despite that, the home was being lived in. Chief Wilson confirmed one fatality, while the Humboldt County coroner has not yet released the victim's name. The deceased is believed to be the son of the injured man. Both were reportedly connected to the property. The surviving resident told first responders he woke to find the house already ablaze. He was taken to a local hospital for treatment. In a tragic turn, Chief Wilson himself entered the structure in an attempt to rescue the second occupant. However, worsening fire conditions and a partial roof collapse forced him to withdraw. Speaking to the red-headed black belt, Wilson said he was able to reach the room where the victim was believed to be, but was ultimately unable to bring him out. He expressed deep sorrow over the loss. The cause of Thursday's fire remains under investigation. Witnesses suggested that an open flame, possibly a candle, may have been in use due to the lack of utilities. Roughly half the home was saved, though the living room and kitchen were destroyed. A neighboring structure sustained heat damage. The Humboldt County Coroner's Office has concluded its on-scene work, but authorities are still working to confirm the identity of the deceased and determine the exact cause of the fire. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office has released new details following a marijuana enforcement operation in Redway earlier this week. According to a press release, deputies with the Sheriff's Marijuana Enforcement Team served a search warrant on May 7th at a residence in the 100 block of Riverview Lane. The property did not have the required county or state permits for commercial cannabis cultivation. During the operation, deputies reportedly eradicated more than 5,000 cannabis plants and seized over 875 pounds of processed cannabis. Also recovered at the scene were several controlled substances, including LSD, psilocybin mushrooms, and suspected ketamine. Deputies also located two ghost guns and more than $21,000 in cash. Two residents, 40-year-old Asha Filion and 45-year-old T. Tirawa McCann were arrested on multiple charges related to illegal cultivation, drug sales, conspiracy, and labor code violations, including failure to pay minimum wage and provide proper pay stubs to employees. Anyone with additional information is urged to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office or the Crime Tip Line. In other crime-related news, the proposed release of a sex offender into the small Humboldt County community of Manila is meeting strong opposition. Daniel Mintz reports.
Placement of a sexually violent predator in Manila is churning intense public opposition, including from Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors. A letter opposing the sex offender's release was on the consent agenda of routine items and pulled for discussion at the May 6th supervisors' meeting. The letter voices the board's firm and unified opposition to conditional release of Richard Stoba into a house in Manila due to his, quote, extensive and violent criminal history that includes multiple rapes, sexual assaults at knife point and gunpoint, and an attempted kidnapping. Now in his 70s, Stoba's criminal savagery was first punished in 1981. His history of violence was summarized by District Attorney Stacey Eads.
Mr. Stoba began sexually violent offenses in 1981 when he preyed upon his first victim, who was an 18-year-old college student. He raped her at knife point in her college dorm. Mr. Stoba was convicted. There was a jury trial related to that particular offense, and he was sentenced to state prison. After serving only 5 years for that offense, Mr. Stoba was released on parole. It wasn't long before he was reoffending, victimizing women. His range of victims included from the 18-year-old up to the age of 71-year-old female victim. He raped a 41-year-old. He raped a number of victims, almost always with the use of a mask covering his identity as he slipped into their homes. He almost always, if not always, was armed with either a firearm or a knife when he committed these offenses.
Now confined at a state mental hospital, Stoba is recommended for conditional release to a house on Peninsula Drive in Manila. But the supervisor's letter states that the release program's, quote, own records indicate that approximately 32% of participants have had their conditional releases revoked for reasons related to community safety. Eads warned against putting Stoba in Manila, saying, quote, we maintain that he's a dangerous individual that is likely to reoffend. Stoba's placement and supervision is managed by a company called Liberty Healthcare, and Chief DA Investigator Kyla Baxley said the company hasn't properly analyzed Manila.
When we were made aware, and due to some confidentiality restrictions, we were unable to present to the public this particular address, we began some proactive efforts in which to showcase the inacceptability of this particular placement in Manila. Liberty presented a site assessment in which I found to be completely subjective and a misrepresentation of what Manila is made of, to include the bus stops, the schools, the daycares, the parks, the open spaces, the open public spaces. Manila over the last several years has gone under some miraculous improvements and a very rightfully prideful community in regards to those communities, but as with any community, has its vulnerabilities, which makes this all the more reason in which this placement is not appropriate. And one might ask, what does appropriate placement for a predator look like? That's yet to be shown, it's yet to be proven, but we know without a shadow of a doubt, Manila is not the place for him.
Sheriff Billy Hansel has also strongly opposed Stoba's release, but couldn't attend the meeting due to being at a meeting in Sacramento. The community's unease was expressed during a public comment period, including by Mario Calson, who is the county's environmental health director.
I'm a resident of Manila and a member of the Peninsula Community Collaborative, which is a group that's trying to make improvements to the community and heal trauma that's been in our community and poverty and things that are hard to work against. And this really sets us back, creates a lot of fear in our community. So I'm here to first off thank Sheriff Hansel for bringing this into the light and making us aware that this proposal was coming to our community, and also to thank the DA's office for engaging, and for you, the Board of Supes, for engaging and being receptive to this idea and sending a clear message. There's intense fears throughout our community, and I wanna represent my family. I have two daughters and a son and two nieces and neighbors, and it's very intense.
The letter is sponsored by Board Chair Michelle Bushnell and Supervisor Mike Wilson, whose district includes Manila. Wilson described the potential release as a high anxiety situation and said, quote, "The community is very, very upset. It's not just Manila, it's also Arcata. The memory of these crimes is burned into the minds and into the soul of the people in the place." Supervisors unanimously approved the letter with an added sentence about how sketchy wireless reception could complicate proposed GPS ankle bracelet monitoring. A court hearing on Stobaugh's release was set for May 7th, but is continued to July 14th. The continuance allows time for review of public comment and new evidence related to Stobaugh's conduct while incarcerated at the hospital. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
It is estimated that as many as one in every 150 Americans suffer from opioid addiction. The opioid epidemic has hit rural America hard in general, and Humboldt County in particular. Official figures from Humboldt's Department of Health and Human Services indicate that deaths linked to opioid use are at least three times higher than the rest of California and the USA. Currently, Soham Health is looking for participants in the county who have opioid use disorder to take part in a study. Sigur Bjorn has more.
The Southern Humboldt Community Health District, or Soham Health, is taking part in a national study to help people in rural areas who suffer from opioid use disorder. Soham Health is looking for local participants for this paid study, which will compare how two formulas of buprenorphine may help people reduce their opioid use. We spoke to Kristen Rees, Chief Compliance and Quality Officer at Soham Health, about the study and what they are looking for in potential participants.
We are working with UCLA, who is the lead node for this study. They're the ones who coordinate the study and have the lead investigators there. There are multiple rural sites that UCLA is working with throughout the nation. We're really excited about the opportunity both to promote rural research as well as better care for our patients and communities. We're looking for those who are 18 years of age and older who have opioid use disorder, or who are currently, seeking medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, and then in good general health, that are willing to be randomized to one of the two medications. And then those who really, really are looking for treatment to quit opioid use, to improve their lives and improve our community. We're really hoping that this can help those who have suffered from opioid use disorder. It's not easy to quit almost any substance, and we're hoping that those who are enrolled in the study, that we can really help support those people. So in addition to being in the study, we can also connect people with outside resources. We have a resource list for any participant that comes, whether or not they continue with the study.
Participants will receive the buprenorphine either sublingually or by injection.
Participants are compensated for completing study visits. Different visits have different amounts that you're compensated for based on what you're doing at those visits. So for a participant, it would be the 14 weeks of treatment. We'll be recruiting through the end of July, and then whatever participants are still in the study will complete treatment. So that could be through the end of October. Those who are interested in participating in the study can contact the study team either by phone or email. The phone number is 707 298-0304. And the email is clinicaltrial@shchd.org.
A longer version of this story will air tomorrow, May 9th, in recognition of National Fentanyl Awareness Day. Stay tuned as we continue our coverage on how opioid addiction is impacting our community and what local efforts are underway to save lives. From underdogs to unstoppable, South Fork softball players are the local Title IV champions. Members of the team stop by our studio to share their story with KMUD's Lauren Schmidt.
Last week, the South Fork Cubs softball team made history, winning both games in a doubleheader against St. Bernard's to take home the Little Four Championship. It's their first league title in at least 20 years, and they didn't just win, they dominated. The Cubs took Game 1 8-2 and Game 2 11-4. With two games left in the season, they're now three wins ahead of the next closest team and have secured the top spot heading into the HDNL postseason tournament. The team is composed of 14 players, mostly freshmen and juniors, and several of the athletes who helped to bring the championship home to Miranda stopped by the KMUD studio on Wednesday to share what this long-awaited victory means to them and their school.
I'm Mackenzie Brewer.
I'm Kendall Kircher.
I'm Molly Perkins.
I'm Layla Coleman. I'm just like 14. I play pitcher and shortstop.
We won the Little Four League Championship for the first time in 35 years.
A lot of excitement. A lot.
Like, we were really like, excited.
We were all really happy.
Me and Kendall were jumping up.
Might have done a little belly bump.
Maybe.
It took a lot of like
mental.
Yeah, mental and like physical.
Going all out.
Just
we
coming
worked
in
really
practice.
Hard. We worked really yeah. hard at practices and stuff
mm-hmm.
to yeah. get to this point.
It's a remarkable comeback for the program that didn't even have a team 2 years ago and has had just one winning season in the league since 2005.
The last 2 years, the girls have really stepped up. They didn't have a team the year before, and then we came back and we won Division 6 playoffs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We ended up winning. And then this year, they came back and won league for the first time since I was a freshman in 1990.
But the players attribute much of their success to their coach, Lisa Todd, who returned from retirement to help rebuild the Cubs softball team.
Shout out to Lisa.
pulled her out of retirement.
Yeah, pulled her out of retirement. Oh, yeah. Now look at us now.
They did. I retired for 2 years. There was another coach that took over, and then she ended up leaving the area, and then they didn't have a coach. They actually had a year of not playing at all, and then they sucked me back in.
The greatest coach of all time. She's yeah. been great.
She's been great. She pushes us hard, but it helps us get to the point we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. We need it.
Yeah, definitely.
Without the coaches we got, I don't think we would be anywhere near where we are now.
South Fork is one of the most rural schools in the league, and for many Southern Humboldt students, sports play a vital role. The Cubs say their social lives would look very different without softball.
It means a lot,
yeah,
honestly.
A lot.
Like, I'd be sitting at home if there was no sports.
Yeah, I'd probably be in bed right now.
Yeah, and without sports, like,
I don't know
how many friends I'd have. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
softball
a
brought,
that's
a huge part.
Everybody together. Like, we're all a big group of friends.
Like, we're just, like, a big family at this point.
Softball's, like, the closest sport we have at our school. Like,
definitely.
Where everyone, like, that's, like, another reason why our team's so good is because we're all, like, niched together. Like, we have really good teamwork.
Yeah.
I feel like it helps boost up, like, South Fork, make us look better mm-hmm. and stuff.
Because a lot of other schools, they doubt us a lot. They think we're just South Fork.
Yeah.
So if they see that we're winning championships, it'll...
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. we're like a really small school, too.
Yeah, compared to everybody else.
The players say they plan to continue playing softball throughout high school and hope to pursue the sport in college and beyond. They draw inspiration from professional female athletes who have stepped into the spotlight and broken barriers in women's sports.
Yeah.
I like hearing about just all these successful like women in sports in college and stuff and how well they're doing. I think it definitely like just helps motivate more to want to do it and to keep doing it and keep on going.
Makes
with
us want to push harder.
Yeah, for sure.
The team's current 17-4 record has earned them a spot in an upcoming tournament.
On the 15th at 7, we play in the Lincoln tournament. And that's the first time we've made it in a few years, made it a couple
Since
years ago.
Since my sister's freshman.
Yeah, and we rarely make that tournament. And this year we got a bye, so we're doing pretty good. And then we'll know playoffs by the following week. And we should be seated pretty high, so we should get some home games.
The public can support the South Fork softball team by cheering them on at their home field in Miranda. And the players are hoping the community will show up in force.
I feel like, honestly, just coming out and supporting us is, like, a really big thing. I feel like it all helps, like, hype us up, just having the crowd behind us, just cheering us on after every single play. Like, if we get a really good double play or something, they go crazy. And it's just, like, a really good, like, energy boost and, like, just a boost to
and it'll rattle the other team a little bit.
Yeah.
It does,
and when
for
the,
sure. It,
when the crowd comes, I feel like we always play harder, too.
Yeah. Way
harder. When we have a bigger crowd.
Yeah.
Because there's actually, like, people to impress.
Yeah.
It's the best.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We get so many people come out and cheer us on.
It's the best.
It's great.
Concluding, they shared a message to the other teams.
Coming for you.
You can find a schedule of upcoming games and more at HumboldtSports.com.
In national news, Canadian Prime Minister Carney tells Trump Canada is never for sale as leaders hold first meeting. Christopher Martinez reports.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney visited President Donald Trump at the White House Tuesday, or as the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation put it, Prime Minister Mark Carney stepped into the lion's den Tuesday. Canada is, of course, America's neighbor to the north, a longtime ally, and our top trading partner. But that relationship has been strained in recent months with Trump's trade war and his remarks about making Canada a 51st state. Those strains did not all get resolved in one meeting, but the visit was mostly cordial. In a joint news conference, Trump praised Carney as a very talented, very good person, and he called Carney's election probably one of the greatest comebacks in the history of politics, maybe even greater than mine.
As you know, just a few days ago, he won a very big election in Canada. And I think I was probably the greatest thing that happened to him, but I can't take full credit.
Carney praised Trump as a transformational president and said, "We're stronger when we work together." But congeniality aside, differences did surface during the leader's Oval Office news conference. For one thing, Trump still wants Canada to become our 51st state, though he did add, "It takes two to tango."
You know, as a real estate developer, you know, I'm a real estate developer at heart. When you get rid of that artificially drawn line, somebody drew that line many years ago with like a ruler, just a straight line right across the top of the country. When you look at that beautiful formation when it's together, I'm a very artistic person, but when I looked at that beauty, I said, that's the way it was meant to be.
Carney shared a different view.
If I may, as you know from real estate, there are some places that are never for sale.
It's true.
We're sitting in one right now. You know, Buckingham Palace that you visited as well.
That's true.
Having met with the owners of Canada over the course of the campaign last several months, it's not for sale, won't be for sale ever.
Trump apparently is not giving up on the idea.
Time will tell. It's only time. But I say, never say never.
Trump also has not given up on the idea of tariffs, saying they'll lower costs for American consumers.
Think of us as a super luxury store, a store that has the goods. You're going to come and you're going to pay a price, and we're going to give you a very good price. We're going to make very good deals, and in some cases, we'll adjust. But that's where it is. And we've been ripped off by everybody for 50 years, for 50 years. And we're just not going to do that anymore. We can't do that.
When a reporter asked whether there was anything Carney could tell him to lift his tariffs of as much as 25% on Canadian imports, Trump bluntly answered no. He added for emphasis, just the way it is. Trump did the lion's share of the talking at the news conference, complete with criticisms of former Presidents Barack Obama and Joe Biden, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and Carney's predecessor, Justin Trudeau. Afterwards, the two leaders met in a closed-door meeting. Carney described the talks as very constructive, though he did not get a resolution to Trump's tariffs.
We're having a very complex negotiation about a wide range of issues. And it's, as I said before I came here, I wouldn't have expected white smoke coming out of this meeting. That was not my expectation, that because of the nature of the negotiation. So you don't expect to have specific progress as things move along, even when you're making progress, because it's a global, that's why it's a global negotiation.
Though issues still remain, Carney said he and Trump are now fully engaged. Meanwhile, as the trade war grinds on, Canada's trade deficit actually narrowed in March. It was driven by a slump in imports from the U.S. following Canada's retaliatory tariffs in response to U.S. tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. Canadian exports to the U.S. also fell, but that was nearly balanced by an increase in Canadian exports to the rest of the world. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
A Freedom Flotilla ship attacked by drones while attempting to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza. Eileen Alfandari reports.
Activists aboard the vessel called the Conscience reported two drone strikes shortly after midnight as their boat was in international waters off of Malta. The strikes caused a fire aboard the ship. Some crew members suffered minor injuries putting out the blaze. The ship was carrying 12 crew members and 4 civilians, but dozens more international activists had assembled in Malta to join the flotilla and head to Gaza. One of them is the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg.
For 2 months now, not a single bottle of water has entered Gaza, and it's a systematic starvation of 2 million people. What happens now is uncertain, but what is certain is that us human rights activists will continue to do everything in our power to do our part to demand a free Palestine and demand the opening of a humanitarian corridor.
Israeli law professor Itamar Mann said that, quote, assuming, as appears to be the case, that the attack is attributable to Israel, it signals a clear violation of the right to life as well as a war crime. As of airtime, the vessel was believed to still be in international waters. A Code Pink member said the nation of Palau revoked its flag from the Conscience prior to the attack and that authorities in Malta, Greece, and Turkey have threatened to confiscate the ship if it comes to port. Activists said the vessel is loaded with medicine and food for Palestinians in Gaza who have suffered the effects of an Israeli blockade for nearly 2 months. When an aid flotilla attempted to break a blockade of Gaza in 2010, Israeli forces stormed a Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, killing 9 people on board. Israeli officials refused to comment on whether they were responsible for this latest apparent attack. Activist groups were attempting to deliver aid as international humanitarian organizations have warned that the humanitarian response in Gaza is on the verge of collapse. The International Committee of the Red Cross said Friday it will not have access to food, medicine, and life-saving supplies needed for many of its Gaza programs if aid deliveries don't resume immediately. In a separate statement, Amnesty International called Israel's blockade of aid to Gaza a genocide in action. The deputy director of the World Health Organization, Michael Ryan, called the situation an abomination.
We are breaking the bodies and the minds of the children of Gaza. We are starving the children of Gaza. Because if we don't do something about it, we are complicit in what is happening before our very eyes. We are complicit.
Meantime, the International Court of Justice concluded a week-long hearing on Israel's obligations under international law to ensure that desperately needed humanitarian aid reaches Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Testimony by representatives for the African Union closed the proceedings. One representative called the situation a human tragedy, with civilians in Gaza deprived of water, food, fuel, and vaccines for children since Israel unilaterally abandoned a ceasefire with Hamas on March 18th.
The humanitarian situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this situation, which was already beyond imagination, has become even more tragic, not to say apocalyptic. Israel has redoubled its efforts to make living conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory impossible. It has decided to ignore its own obligations as an occupying power to guarantee the individual and collective human rights of Palestinians.
The United Nations General Assembly has asked the International Court for an advisory opinion on what Israel's obligations are as an occupying power and member of the United Nations. The court's advisory opinion isn't expected for months, and Israel is likely to ignore it anyway, as it has previous rulings. I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, and thanks to our reporters. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Audible, and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Joel Ficklin.